listener production.
What do we as a nation need to do to fight climate change? To answer this question and many others, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg and I are joined by Alan Finkel, who was Australia's chief scientist from 2016 to 2020, where he led the National Electricity Market Review, the development of the National Hydrogen Strategy, and the panel that advised the Australian government on the 2020 Low Emissions Technology Roadmap. He's currently Chair of Style Education and Special Advisor to the Australian Government on Low Emissions Technologies. Together, we discuss Australia's long-term emission reduction plan and the sustainable technology that will be used, the future of electric cars, and what every single Australian can do to play their part in achieving net zero by 2050.
Good education, having a curriculum that doesn't take the easy approach. The cruelest thing you can do to young people is to set that bar of aspiration low. Set it high and help them get over it.
My name is Sarah Grimberg. Each month, Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg and I will discuss the topics affecting our lives as Australians. In a time where transparency is critical, Josh will answer the important questions often not asked in the media. This is the Josh Frydenberg Podcast with Sarah Grimberg. Josh, great to see you again. Joining us today is Alan Finkel, Australia's former chief scientist, as well as being the Australian government's special advisor on the 2020 Low Emissions Technology Roadmap. Welcome, Alan. Climate change is obviously one of the most important crises facing our world today, so this conversation is so unbelievably important.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Great to be with you, and Alan, welcome. And you have been a thought leader in the technology space, in science, in engineering. You've been the president of the Australian Academy of Engineering, chancellor of a university, chief scientist, active and successful in the private sector. You've basically made every post a winner. And now you're doing that in the area of climate and energy and technology development. I thought it really interesting, Alan, that recently you authored a very significant piece of work, a quarterly essay titled Getting to Zero, and it was all about how technology would help us meet that target. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about your thoughts in that project?
Sure. The fundamental thesis there is to tackle the biggest aspect of the problem first. Nearly three quarters of all of our global emissions, and in Australia as well, nearly three quarters comes from the energy sector, from burning oil, coal and gas to give us what we need. Our civilization absolutely depends on freely available energy. So what do we do about it? We have to replace it with a zero emissions equivalent. So in the quarterly essay, I defined a three-step process. Step one, look at our existing electricity system and decarbonize it. We're well underway, about 30% of the way there. 30% of our energy in the last quarter, of our electricity in the last quarter, came from solar, wind, and a little bit of hydro.
It's a real transition underway.
You can see how we're going to get to 100% zero emissions electricity in the existing system. Then you've got to say, where else are we using energy in substantial quantities? The transport sector is an obvious one, and there's a revolution underway globally to transition our small vehicles and our big vehicles to run on batteries or hydrogen, some kind of derivative of fuel produced by electricity. To power that, we're going to need a lot more electricity, so we're going to pretty much have to double what we do and produce twice as much electricity as what we started with. So we're doing all the things electricity currently does, computers, motors, air conditioning, plus the transport sector. Then you look, where else are we using energy? It's building heating, it's industrial low-temperature heating, industrial high-temperature heating, cooking, all sorts of things. We can replace that with electricity and things made from electricity. And by the time you do these three big transitions into electricity, we will have tripled, literally tripled, the amount of electricity that we will be producing in the national electricity market in future. Now, you don't do them sequentially. You do it as an overlapping fashion so that we will get to a point where all of our primary energy is being produced by electricity. And I have a phrase for that. I call that the electric planet.
Have you been surprised by how quickly the technologies come on? I mean, Sarah and I, you know, we hear these statistics, one in four Australian households with solar panels on their roofs. I don't know if you've got solar panels, Sarah.
I do.
Oh, there you go. You see? It's obviously come on in leaps and bounds, and Australia has been actually at the cutting edge of that technological development. UNSW, University of New South Wales, has helped develop that solar cell technology, which is now ever-present in commercial development of solar cell technology. So have you been surprised, Alan, as a scientist?
I have been surprised, deeply surprised, but let me say pleasantly surprised. So I remember speaking to my uncle in the early 2000s, and he was saying to me, oh, solar is going to really make a huge difference. I said, listen, uncle, it's so expensive. It's hard to see it getting to the level that we're going to need quickly enough. And I wasn't alone. I think every pundit back in 2000 or the early 2000s anticipating the reduction in price of solar electricity got it wrong. None of us saw how quickly the price of solar would come down. It's come down by about 12% per year every single year, which really means it's coming down by about 90% per decade. It's stunning. And you're right, Josh, Australians have been early adopters, and now about a quarter of all households in Australia have solar, which is a world record. I think that's about a third of addressable households. Not every house is suitably positioned to have solar. So we're at about a third of what we could ever hope to get to. That's pretty fast because, you know, we're talking about 3 million households already, another 6 million or thereabouts to go. We are the world leader in Australia in adoption of solar. If you look at the solar generation from all sources, rooftops and large solar farms, per capita, Australia has the largest generation of solar electricity per person in the world. It's pretty impressive. Just going to the other point you mentioned about the University of New South Wales, some significant technology has been developed there, but it goes back 20 or 30 years. And now, today, more than 90% of all the solar panels that are made anywhere in the world, whether they're made in China or Germany or America or India, more than 90% of all the solar panels in the world use technology developed at the University of New South Wales.
What are the bigger technologies coming up that you see for helping with climate change?
Well, Sarah, you mentioned that I chaired the Low Emissions Technology Roadmap, and that came out in 2020.
Yep.
And in Glasgow, about a week ago, the Australian government, Minister Taylor, announced a significant update to that roadmap. And in there, we identified a portfolio of significant technologies, technologies where each of them would have a significant reduction or abatement potential of carbon dioxide emissions, where they would build on Australia's comparative advantages, where they would have significant economic potential, and where they was sufficiently advanced that Australian government investment and co-investment with industry would make a difference. And that portfolio of six technologies is as follows. The first one is hydrogen. Hydrogen can be used as a fuel. There's huge international interest, and Australia can become a supplier, and we're targeting hydrogen production for less than $2 a kilogram by 2030.
Wow.
The second one is ultra-low-cost solar electricity. So solar, before it's integrated into the system, is already the cheapest form of electricity. And we want to reduce it down to a third of what it is today. Today, it's about $45 a megawatt hour. That's just the unit of electricity. We're trying to get it down to $15 per megawatt hour by 2030, which will help us to make cheap hydrogen and help us to reduce the cost of electricity to households and industries and the other priority technologies. The third one is electrical energy storage. As we go to solar and wind into the electricity grid, they're wonderful in the sense that they're zero emissions, but they're badly behaved from an electrical point of view, and they have to be supported by storage, battery storage, pumped hydro storage, hydrogen storage, many different ways of doing it. And we've got a target price and date to get the cost of large-scale storage down to a level that we can really make the transition to solar and wind cost-effectively. Then we looked at low-emissions metals, so zero-emissions steel and zero-emissions aluminium. Crucially important globally, steelmaking is responsible for 7% of global emissions, aluminium about 4%, so very, very significant.
And also very important for Australia because we're currently, you know, big exporters, not just of iron ore, but also coal, which go into that steelmaking process. So for Australia to be at the top table, so to speak, of that technological development Alan, that's going to facilitate ongoing steelmaking into the future, maybe modifying the use of materials that are part of that. But that's good news for Australia.
It's very good news for Australia because we've got to look for our opportunities in the future. So at the moment, we're the biggest iron ore exporter in the world, and we're one of the biggest exporters of metallurgical coal, which is used in other countries to make steel, a little bit here in Australia. But in future, that's going to change. It might take a decade, 2 decades, or 3 decades, but we have to look at what will be the replacement for metallurgical coal exports. And it turns out that you can make zero-emission steel, green steel, if you want to call it that, by using hydrogen with the iron ore. So we can see a future where we're exporting hydrogen and iron ore, so that in China and Japan and Korea and other places, they're making green steel. So we're not just looking at the steel making, we're looking at the end-to-end supply chain. So Australia's got opportunity in the iron ore export, the upgrading of the iron ore into pure iron, hot briquetted iron it's called, as well as exporting the hydrogen. It's enormous opportunity, and equivalently with bauxite and alumina and aluminium itself. And then the last thing I should say is that the technology roadmap recognises that you can't get to net zero by eliminating all emissions. There's a reason they call it net zero. You reduce the emissions as much as you can, but we're not likely to get beyond about 85 or 90% from where we are today, because there are just some things you can't eliminate while human beings are walking the surface of the earth. So you have to...
The belching of cows, maybe?
Well, I think we could do a pretty good job on the belching of cows, but we'll probably reduce it by 85 or 90% when cows burp or belch. They're belching methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. So there's always going to be some residual greenhouse gases in every country of the world. Nowhere would you get to zero just directly. So you've got to say, okay, what do we do with that final 10 or 15%? We have to offset it, or let me use the vernacular, we have to mop it up. So we've got two priorities for mopping up. One is called geosequestration, which really is the fancy word for carbon capture and storage. And the other one is biosequestration, which is storing carbon dioxide or carbon in the soil in this particular case.
Which creates opportunities for our farmers too.
It does.
And we're already, Sarah, doing this sort of stuff through various funds that we've established. Woodside, for example, have got major gas facilities and assets here in Australia, and they've heavily invested in carbon capture and storage, and our farm sector's heavily invested in carbon farming and carbon storage. So there's good opportunities here in Australia too to lead that.
Well, there's several opportunities. One that's been going on for a while in biosequestration is the Emissions Reduction Fund.
Yeah.
And that's been paying farmers to store for the long term carbon in trees through forestation and afforestation. Now we're working on, and the methods have been developed, to pay farmers for storing carbon in the soil. It's really difficult. It's really difficult to measure. But we've invested in the measurement technologies to take the cost out of the measurement so that it's a cost-effective thing for farmers to do. So the Emissions Reduction Fund has really given farmers new opportunities in this decarbonising world.
You know, we're talking about a lot of complex topics. We're talking about a lot of future technologies. If you're sitting at home and thinking, how does this affect me? Can you give us a sense, Alan, about what it means for households, for families?
Yeah.
Obviously, they're thinking about the price of electricity. They're thinking about the reliability of electricity, but they're also thinking, importantly, about the carbon footprint and the environmental goal and objective of reducing emissions. So what does this practically mean for those listening at home? Is the way they're going to get their electricity going to change? Is the price of their electricity going to change? Certainly, when you spoke about cars, the vehicles that people drive are going to change over time as well.
People are legitimately conflicted. They want to contribute to reducing emissions, but they're scared about jobs and the price of electricity and things like that. And what we're seeing through the work that we're doing through the Low Emissions Roadmap, the Australian government's delivery plan to get to net zero, is that there will be jobs in the future in these new industries. There are huge export opportunities for Australia, which will increase the prosperity of the whole of the economy. And actually, costs for energy at home should go down. We're already seeing that. Josh, you'll remember back in 2016 and 2017, when I was working for you and the government, the electricity review, prices were going through the roof and they've come down substantially. And, you know, it's hard to actually attribute why, but to some significant extent, it's because solar and wind electricity are much cheaper than what they're replacing. And with the ultra low cost solar priority target in the low emissions technology roadmap, electricity should get cheaper. Now, think about transport. All those electric vehicles, which will become, I think, the dominant form of passenger car in coming decades, they need to be charged. They need electricity. Some people will get the electricity straight off their own solar panels, but others will get it through the poles and wires in the streets. Now, currently, the cost of the poles and wires is a big component of your bill, and they're not fully utilised because they're built for the worst case, for the biggest electrical load, but often they're working at night time, working hardly at all. But if we can manage the charging of those electric vehicles in an intelligent way, and this is one of the things that's covered in the Future Fuels Vehicle Strategy that was published just this week, if we can manage the charging in an intelligent way, we'll deliver more electricity with the same poles and wires. That means the cost per unit of electricity to the average consumer will go down because the poles and wires are being used more efficiently. So if we're smart about this, if we go with the flow, if we stop trying to resist, we can intelligently reduce our emissions and lower costs for consumers.
Alan, what changes do us Aussies need to make to achieve the targets in the plan?
As individuals?
Yeah.
The strongest power of an individual, I'm sure the Treasurer would like to think it's their voting, but really I think the strongest power that an individual has is their purchasing decisions. If they take that extra little bit of effort to look for products that were made with low carbon content, and that's going to get labelled more and more going forward. If they buy an electric car for their next electric car, and it depends, of course, the cost of the cars and their purchasing ability, but if it's within their budget for their next car to be an electric car, they should do that. If it's within their budget to choose to purchase green offset electricity, they should do that. If it's within their budget to put solar on their rooftops, they should do that. Those purchasing decisions send signals to companies and influence how companies invest in their new product.
Well, a good example is what's happened on solar panels, with Australia having the highest take-up on a per capita basis. Now, a lot of people getting solar panels have done so because they want to reduce their emissions. It's also become a cost-effective decision for them. And that's what we have to do with these new technologies, is get them to a price that it becomes a no-brainer for people to change their consumer habits or businesses to change their business models.
That's right. You want the low emissions and the low prices. It only takes about 5 or 6 years to get a payback on putting in solar panels.
Mm.
And then you get the benefit of 15 years beyond that. So it's fantastic. Looking at electric cars, where they're in larger volumes, say in Europe, all the predictions are that just within another couple of years, they'll get to the parity point where the total cost of ownership of two comparable cars in terms of size and fit out, a petrol car and electric car, will be in favour of the electric car. That's total cost of ownership, where the sticker price, the purchase price might be a bit higher, but your running cost is a lot lower because electricity is about a third of the price per kilometre driven than petrol, and your service costs are very, very low because there's not much to fix. There are very few moving parts. And then it's only another 2 or 3 years beyond that, certainly before the end of this decade, where the sticker price is likely to be cheaper for a comparable electric car compared to a petrol car. And then you get everything. You get low emissions driving, lower cost, and a much better driving experience.
Josh, as the Treasurer, how do you think about a low emissions future?
Well, Sarah, for us and for me, I don't see it as a binary choice between a lower emissions future and a stronger economy. Clearly, my focus is how do we keep creating jobs? How do we keep driving investment? How does Australia continue to grow? Because it's only with economic growth and a stronger economy can you fund all the other services that are expected of government. It's interesting if you look back at what we've done as a country since 2005, because that was the benchmark that was set at Paris for a 2030 target. Now, we said we would reduce our emissions by 26 to 28% on what they were in 2005. We're down more than 20%. In comparison, that's faster than the US, Canada, Japan, even New Zealand, who are down by just about 1%, whereas we're down by more than 20%. At the same time, our economy has grown by 45%, and there's an additional 3 million people in work. So I think it's really important as an economy, as a country, as a government, that we understand that you don't have to choose between a lower emissions future and a stronger economy. That being said, you do need to have a plan, and that plan needs to be thought out. That plan needs to be properly funded. That plan needs to invest in those new technologies. And rather than punishing various approaches, which is the higher taxes idea, we're all about putting incentives on the table and driving down the cost of technology so that it can be more readily available and people can make that informed choice. It's a unilateral decision for a lot of people to go and adopt that way of doing things.
Can you tell us a bit about the new jobs that will be created from this?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about hydrogen, we talked about electric vehicles, we've talked about our steel industry and our aluminium industry. Now, this will create jobs and maintain jobs at the same time. I think a lot of startups today are thinking about how they leverage off the changes in our economy and the transition. I'm seeing a tidal wave of global capital that is now being directed into these new technology investments. And that's one of the reasons why I spoke, you know, quite publicly. People think of it in terms of cost of investments required to get action, but there's also a cost of inaction in that if we hadn't signed on to net zero by 2050, I was concerned we'd be disadvantaged in the search for capital or the access to global capital to fund our businesses, to fund our banks, to fund the Australian economy. So there is lots of money out there. It's going into new technology investments, and in doing so, it's helping to create a lot of new jobs. But Alan, you've been involved also in the biotech space, but you can see how those investor decisions are going to drive technology development.
I can, Josh, and I see it at all levels. So in the last 3 years, there's been $35 billion invested into solar and wind and renewables.
Since 2017.
And billions of dollars invested into the economy leads to jobs, however you want to analyze it does. But also, I get to see some of the startup companies. Josh mentioned startups. One of our startups, one in Glasgow, they had a pitch event which apparently had more than 300 entries, and an Australian startup won the pitch event, which is fantastic. Yeah. There's a Newcastle-based company called Lavo, L-A-V-O, that is making a hydrogen-based battery pack for home, about three times bigger than a Tesla Powerwall. They only started earlier in the year. In May, when they went public, they got 5,000 pre-orders for this $35,000 battery pack, where people actually had to put a deposit down with their pre-orders. The consumer interest in these technologies is huge.
Can you tell us, Alan, you talked about electric cars earlier on. Can you tell us about the benefits of electric cars? What is the future of electric cars, especially within Australia?
So the clear benefit is emissions reduction. And some people have said to me, because I've been driving an electric car for 8 years, living in Melbourne, they say, oh, Alan, you're plugging in your car in Melbourne. It's all coming from brown coal generators. What a terrible thing to be doing. And I'm saying, stop, stop, stop. Just so that you can't accuse me, I am paying for clean green electricity, I'm paying a premium. But the reality is these electric cars are a technology of the future. Once you've bought an electric car, every year it becomes a lower emission vehicle than the previous year because the electricity grid is getting better and better and better. And it's quite clear, an electric car plugged in Australia today is lower emissions than a petrol car, and the gap will just grow and grow and grow. So one benefit is lower emissions. The other is convenience. When you've got a battery electric car, you don't have to drive off to the petrol station. So in 8 years, the only place we've ever recharged our electric car is in the garage at home. I feel sorry for people who have to drive to the petrol station on the way home. It's tough. But the third thing, and I'll tell you this, that unless you actually go out and sit behind the wheel of an electric car, you won't be able to appreciate it at a visceral level. Driving an electric car is a much better experience than driving a petrol car. The only way I can describe it to people is you're all used to watching large format flat screen TVs. Imagine if I said, get rid of that, go back to the old box TV, it shows you the picture, it's moving, it's colour. What's
Netflix,
the difference?
Get your VHS out. You know,
yeah, what's the difference? You know there's a difference. When you get behind an electric car, it is so responsive.
Yeah.
It's a special pleasure to drive.
I'm interested in your views on the global progress towards net zero. Now, clearly, a number of countries, over 130, have committed to getting there. But the world's largest emitter is China, nearly a third of the world's emissions. India, another major country with a growing middle class. They've been seeing their emissions go up quite dramatically year on year. How do you think those countries will get their emissions down into the future? How long will it take? And is global pressure going to be a major push factor here?
So Josh, I worry because most of the countries are making pledges but not plans. And one of the things that I'm most proud of being part of the technology roadmap, which the Australian government has put out, is that it really is a plan. It's saying this is how we will get to zero. It doesn't have everything worked out, but it's saying this is how we'll get to zero. And other countries are making pledges, and I can't find where their plan is. Some do. The UK is fantastic in that sense. Some do, but a lot don't. And I would like to see the global narrative change from pledges to actual expressions of how they're going to get there. Will China do it? China is remarkable. They've shown again and again and again how they can do things at a scale that no one's ever comprehended, but I haven't seen the plan for how they're going to get there. Really, Australia is a standout for having a systematic approach at the Commonwealth level and the state level, that combined is delivering real value.
Alan, how did you get into the energy space?
So I started off as the chief scientist in early 2016, not having a clue what I would be doing, and all sorts of things came up. But basically, there was a blackout in South Australia. Most people will remember it. It was the first time for decades that a whole state had gone black. Now, South Australia was the state that was leading the shift to renewables. So when this blackout happened in a storm, there was a lot of angst, a lot of finger-pointing, complaints about policies, operation of the system. It was bad. Coincidences count. About a week later, I was giving the keynote speech at Scotch College for the launch of their science building. And that's in Josh's electorate, and it was named after Zelman Cowan. So Zelman Cowan, the real close mentor.
Former Governor General.
Former Governor General. But your Public mentor, I think you were one of his three pets. Josh was there with the family. And as I came down from doing a pre-tour of the science building, Josh walked in and he said, Alan, he touched his head. I have to speak to you later. So I gave the speech, had some friends who came to the speech and we went out for dinner. We drank scotch because we'd just been speaking at Scotch College. Driving home, and I wasn't driving. As we arrived home at about 10:30, quarter to 11, I got a phone call from Josh and he was very tired. He was saying to me, Alan, you know about the blackout? And I said, of course I do. I've even been to Adelaide and hearing about it. He said, I've just been speaking to the Prime Minister. I just got off the phone. We're very concerned about this. We think there should be a review and that you should share it. And as I started to say, because this was going to be big, as I was trying to sort of say something, and Josh said, and I'm so tired, and he hung up on me.
Did I really?
You did. And then the next morning, about 8:30, I got a call from Josh again. He said, Alan, I'm at the COAG meeting of energy ministers. So it's all the state ministers, and the chair is, of course, the federal minister, Josh, as the energy minister, and he says, I put it to them, they all agree there should be a review and you should chair it. And I tried again to say, bup, 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 bup. And he said, and now I've got to go back in. And he hung up on me again.
And well, then, there's a bit of license there.
I guess the next thing I did know, I remember very well, Josh, the next thing was I called up the secretary at the Department of Environment and Energy, Gordon DeBrower.
Nice man.
A wonderful person. And I said, Gordon, do you know about this? And he says, yeah, of course, I'm in the meeting. And I said, what'll I do? I said, help. And he said, get over here. And he started a process with the Australian government, public service operating at its best, created a task force. Josh, you selected the panel and things went superbly well from then.
We had the Finkel Review, subsequently had the National Energy Guarantee. We obviously had a few challenges with that, but then things like the Reliability Guarantee came out of that, and that's been important.
It's been effective.
It's been an important part of the implemented system now to help stabilise the grid. So thank you, Alan, for your public service then, your public service now, and I'll never hang up on you again.
And you didn't. And it continued because after that, a lot of people asked me about hydrogen. And they said to me, Alan, you've done electricity. What are you going to do about hydrogen? I said, nothing. I've got no interest in hydrogen. But they kept coming at me. And eventually I pulled a group of industry experts, government experts and research experts together. We had a discussion and I became quite convinced that hydrogen was going to be an important part of the future economy. And so this time I rang Josh because he was the energy minister. I knew him well from the Electricity Review. And I said, Josh, what do you know about hydrogen? He said, nothing. And he said, but he asked a really important question. He said, should I? I said, yes. And he said, get over here. And I came over and gave him a little briefing and things just led on from there.
Well, you've got to know what you don't know, Sarah. That's the
Alan, what do you think about education of children on climate change and bringing it into schools and making them understand exactly what's happening with our world so that they can do what they can to make our world a better place by doing their share?
There's just nothing more important than giving our young children high-quality education so that they can be the thinkers and the leaders and the workers and the doers of the future. And I've been very involved in science education for the last 15 years now. I started some science education programs. I started a science magazine, a popular science magazine, which had a series of lessons called Cosmos Lessons. I've started a company to do science education resources for teachers. The critically important thing is not to make it too easy for kids. You really want them to be thinkers and to know stuff. So the challenge is to set the bar of aspirations fairly high, just like you would for a high jumper, and then to coach the kids so that they can get over the bar. What we want is kids who know how to think, but also can quite deeply know something about the material. It's not enough to know how to think. You hear all people saying 21st century skills, you just need to be creative, clear thinking, know how to cooperate and things like that. That's only half of it. You need to have something to be cooperative about. You need to know things. Mm. What I'd want is for our kids to emerge from school knowing how to distinguish an evidence-based theory from a conspiracy theory. And that takes good education, investment in teachers, investment in resource materials, having a curriculum that doesn't take the easy approach. The cruelest thing you can do to young people is to set that bar of aspiration low. Set it high and help them to get over it.
One thing that struck me, Sarah, as being when I was the Energy and the Environment Minister, is not just how contested this debate has been, but how so much of the noise was coming from the extremes.
Mm.
And that's the extreme on the right and the extremes on the left. You either believed in it or you didn't believe in it. It's not a religion. It's an empirically based, evidence-based discussion, and it should be around engineering, economics, and environmental objectives, and how those three come together. And I was always struck by the fact that people either wanted action or didn't want action, but there wasn't a lot of knowledge all the time about the intimate details, the intricate details of the debate. And there are real issues about reliability. I mean, we talked about South Australia, we could talk about the massive jump in wholesale energy prices in Victoria after the closure of Hazelwood, which was an old, dirty, brown coal-fired power station. But when it happened, there was a vacuum. And, you know, suddenly a quarter of Victoria's energy supply was taken out, and Victoria went from being an energy exporter to being an energy importer at critical times. So you can't just make decisions based on a hunch here. You have to work it all through. And that's why a target 30 years out, 2050, needs to be very much based on a plan, but also the recognition that over that time, technologies will change, costs will come down. There'll be things that we haven't thought about today that become standard fare back, you know, at that time. So I think that critical thinking that you're talking about, Alan, in the next generation of scientists and engineers and economists is going to be critical, because it's going to inform, hopefully, what is a constructive debate and not one that plays out of the extremes.
It's also going to produce the next generation of engineers and scientists and investors, economists, who can plan all of this. One of the strengths of the 2050 plan that the government introduced is that they've got a 15% of the remaining emissions reduction from technologies yet to be developed. Now, I have heard people criticise that. To the contrary, it's a recognition of the fact that human innovation, human ingenuity is a constant. And to think that people would expect the government to produce a plan today for the next 29 years that knows every single detail is ludicrous. Quite rightly, the plan says, yes, in Australia, in other countries, young people will be educated and deliver the solutions. We've got to get them a lot of the way there. We owe it to them with existing technologies. We've got to expect that there will be new inventions that will help us to get there.
We spoke earlier just about how you've been a great success story in the private sector, publicly listing a company, selling it, having founded it in Silicon Valley. And then obviously you've been very successful in public life as well as a chief scientist in the many other roles, including as Chancellor of Monash University. It seemed to me that it's going to be really important that when we have our university sector and our researchers working hand in glove with industry and ensuring that that private capital is funneled in the right way, and that we're not duplicating efforts in one part of the country compared to another, that there's global partnerships as well, because no one should be denied the access to work with other leaders in the field, and that can be to the net benefit of the environment and the economy. So how do you think Australia is going in that regard? How can we even do more in that regard?
So when you look at the research pipeline all the way through to commercialization, probably the sector in the Australian world of research that is best structured is this low emissions technology, the energy sector. So we've got four pillars in the pipeline. The first is fundamental research in our universities. Treasurer, I have to say to you, as a scientist, we need more money for fundamental research. But they are delivering really good ideas and knowledge. Then we've got the sector for translational research. That's pillar number two. That's where the CSIRO and the CRCs excel.
The cooperative research centres.
The CRCs are the cooperative research centres, and there are quite a few of them focused on the energy sector and the transition. Then we've got ARENA, the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, which is funding demonstration level projects. So it's going beyond the research translation into let's prove it on the ground with some significant money. They've just done a fantastic job over 10 years. They got refunded on the back of the low emissions technology roadmap last year for the next 10 years, which is wonderful. And then we've got the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, the CEFC. It's a bank purely for low emissions technologies. It's probably the largest in the world that is government owned with such a specific purpose. So we've got fundamental research, translational research, demonstration programs, and early stage deployment funding. So it's a wonderful continuum. More money always helps, but these processes attract a lot of private capital as well. And that's one of the extraordinary things we're seeing now, where private capital is lining up at a level beyond what government can do. In Glasgow, we saw that the governments are discussing how they can put $100 billion into helping countries to reduce their emissions. And the investors are standing there and saying, we've got $130 trillion that we wanted to put into low emissions technologies and financing the transition. So governments have stimulated and will continue to stimulate the transition and the knowledge generation. But ultimately, you need a sustainable market. You need consumers expressing their preference, which attracts companies into those markets and investors. And all of a sudden, it all works.
Josh, what makes you excited about the world that we're moving towards?
Well, I think we're successfully moving to a world where we are reducing our emissions and focusing on that important environmental objective, but at the same time backing new technologies to get us there in a way that lowers energy prices, increases the stability of the grid. Take Snowy 2.0. We haven't talked about that today, but that's a big battery effectively for the east coast of Australia. The carbon capture and storage initiatives, the soil carbon, the work we're doing on battery technology, solar cell technology, and of course hydrogen, all of which I think are exciting for Australia because we've got comparative advantages. Overall, it's the approach and the plan. I think from our perspective as a government, it was a significant step and a significant step forward to agree on the net zero target. As you know, it was quite a battle internally, differing views, but we worked through it. We allowed the process to run its course and, you know, we got there in time for Glasgow and the Prime Minister's trip. And so for us, I think that is important. You also have to recognise that these issues are extremely complex. It's not just about a headline number, a target. It's got to be about all the things that come under that, and that's why I think a plan is so important. So I feel like we've made real progress recently. I feel like Australia can benefit now from the technologies that are available, the capital that is available, and obviously we've got the skills and we've got the people here who can lead us there.
Can I add that the declaration of the net zero 2050 target completes what we need to make fabulous progress? People talk about ambition. Ambition, in my mind, is formed of three things. You need a target, then you need a plan, and then you need the actions. So if you go by analogy, I was talking about high jumping before. Go with the analogy of high jumping again. Some young kid who thinks, I want to win Olympic gold. That's the target. The plan is a training plan, and the action is you've got to turn up for training. And if you don't have all three of those things, you will not win Olympic gold. And now we've got it. We've got the target, we've got the plans, and we've got policies and funding that are delivering the actions.
Yep.
Is it enough? It's never enough. Can we do more? We will do more. One of the things that I like very much about the roadmap that I've been asked to chair is that it's an enduring process. So the first roadmap came out in 2020. Last week, the big update was released in Glasgow, and there's a commitment to do another one next year. And it's adaptive because we recognise that the needs are evolving, the technological opportunities are evolving, the financial market interests are changing. So it's actually best practice to have an ongoing annual update to such a big, important issue.
Alan Finkel, it's been an absolute pleasure having you with us today. Your insight and wisdom is so unbelievably valuable. So thank you for that. And Josh, thank you for all your work with climate change as well.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. And well, we've been treated here, I think, to a great series of insights from Alan. And Alan, as I sit opposite you here in the studio post-lockdown, you've had a haircut. And I think that's a big development here because when I saw him over a screen recently, Sarah, he had this massive whisk of hair, and as a professor, he reminded me of Doc from Back to the Future. There's a lot of similarities here, you know. He's not taking us back to the past; he's taking us to the future. So, thank you for all you do, Alan.
Josh, that was my lockdown protest, not having a haircut. And now we're out of lockdown.
It was mandatory, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, no, yes. I could have asked my wife to cut my hair. One of the real pleasures that I've had over the last 4 years is working with you as Energy Minister and keeping up a friendship in your role as Treasurer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. Josh Frydenberg podcast with Sarah Grimberg. The audio producer is Matt Curry and the producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Listener.